At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Jobs or GDP? Jobs or GDP? Jobs or GDP? Where, oh, where should we start? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, I do believe, 28 September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Jobs, it turns out, are where we're going to start today, because despite the best efforts of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, cooling down the American labor market is not. Today being Thursday, as I said, we got a new figure for the number of people making first-time claims for unemployment benefits, up just a hair, 204,000 last week. That 204,000 is, yes, a lot of people losing their jobs, but it is on the low end of normal for first-time claims, and all the more remarkable for how fast and how far the Fed has been raising interest rates. The job market in this country is especially strong in three very different states, Louisiana, Maryland, and North Dakota, each of which have set record lows for their jobless rates. So Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall gets us going by checking in with some people in all three of those places.
In Maryland, the first stop on our low unemployment tour, the rate is 1.7%. Joe Gonzalez with talent firm Robert Half says to attract talent there, firms are leaning in to perks like remote work, flexible hours.
I think people are just starting to listen to what's really important to their current employees as well as future potential hires.
Eli Allen at the nonprofit Civic Works says the low-wage workers he trains for construction careers have potential employers lining up to meet them.
We've had the benefit now of having a lot of employers apply to join our program and being able to screen those employers and ensure that we're focusing on working with companies that are committed to paying good wages.
But day laborers aren't reaping the same benefits, says Lindolfo Carballo with advocacy group CASA.
They are the ones that are less protected. Workers are even threatened by employers saying, if I'm going to pay you this, but if you ask for more, I'm going to call immigration.
More than 1,300 miles away in Fargo, the unemployment rate is 1.9%. North Dakota State University economist Thomas Crummell says the jobs market has been good for workers, especially his agricultural economics students.
The econ student, as an example, was getting a $70,000 a year salary on average.
There's also a huge crunch in service jobs. He says many restaurants in Fargo don't open Sundays or Mondays because there's a shortage of workers. It's a similar story in Louisiana, where 3.3% are out of work. Andrew Fitzgerald works for the Baton Rouge Area Chamber.
Employers are having to start thinking about, where do we find kind of pockets of talent that we didn't normally need to recruit from?
He says employers are more open to hiring teens and people who were previously incarcerated. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
On Wall Street on this Thursday, what is not to love? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The good people at the Bureau of Economic Analysis shared with us the third estimate of second quarter GDP today. We'll explain that third estimate thing in a minute. But the thing that's important right now is that the economy grew at an annualized rate of 2.1% April through June, unchanged from the second estimate of Q2, which came out a month ago. Unchanged, and yet...
I was on my computer at 8:30, staring at the BEA's website, waiting for that press release to come across.
That's Nicole's survey. She's an economist with Wells Fargo.
So I was not waiting for it at 8:30 Eastern this morning. I actually went out and got breakfast with my wife, so that was a nice way to start the day. But we did do a little bit of prep yesterday to get our files ready.
That's St. Louis Fed economist Charles Gaskin, who's got his priorities straight, by the way. Breakfast first, always. But about that third estimate thing, we went straight to the source.
And I do live and breathe GDP.
Do what you love, right?
My name is Dave Washausen, and I'm the Associate Director for National Economic Accounts here at BEA.
Dave Washausen and his team at National Accounts take a number of swings at GDP.
Starting with an advance estimate that comes out 30 days after the reference quarter. Super fast relative to what other countries do, I will say.
Super fast indeed. I'll allow the humble brag there. The next estimate comes 30 days after that, after more survey data comes in. And the third estimate comes out about 30 days after that, all of it carefully scheduled.
There are no surprises. We strive to eliminate surprises for data users.
The big data headline today, as I said, was that second quarter GDP came in right on par with Q1. You dig a little deeper, though, and there are some details of note.
Personal consumption, which is essentially your read on total consumer spending in the United States, that was revised down in this third estimate.
Meaning people weren't spending as much as we thought they had been spending. But
I don't think that this print in particular materially changes the contours of our broader economic outlook.
Economists like Nicole are going to use these revisions to update their forecasts to sharpen those contours, if you will, of the overall economic picture. And then when the next revisions come, they're going to do it all over again.
I mean, I have a hard time keeping track of like my own household budget and all these other kind of numbers that we all have to deal with. So to think about just the scale and scope of this project, I mean, what the data shows is that these revisions from a broad scale are relatively small.
Charles Gaskin at the St. Louis Fed with the last word there. Also, thanks to Nicole's survey at Wells Fargo, Dave Washausen at the BEA. Notwithstanding that Q2 dip we were just talking about a minute ago, the past couple of years, American consumers have generally been really resilient, by which I mean willing to keep on spending and in so doing driving this economy. Part of that has been, of course, pent-up pandemic demand, and part of it's been consumers having a lot of pent-up savings, money not spent during the early years of the pandemic. But those savings are running out, and they are running out soon. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains what that might mean big picture.
People saved money in a lot of different ways during the pandemic.
Yeah, I was living in Milwaukee at the time. The cost of living was really low, so I was able to save a lot then.
I went back home to live with my parents.
Moved in with my boyfriend.
Aminata Ngom was in Wisconsin. Jordan St. Laurent was in Florida. David Liu was in New York. But when you look at data from the nation's bank accounts, anonymous data, as the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute did, turns out a lot of savings came from COVID relief payments from the government. Remember those?
After each one of those three rounds of payments went out, we saw balances really shoot way, way up.
Chris Wheat is president of the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute.
And after that third round in April of 2021 is really when those balances were at their absolute highest, more or less across income groups.
As people squirreled away cash, the personal saving rate went from about 9% in late 2019 to an all-time record high of almost 34% later in 2020. Luis Edgar Oliveira is a lead associate economist with the San Francisco Fed Research Department. He and a colleague estimated that the total amount of all those extra savings, savings above and beyond normal, peaked in the summer of 2021.
And that number, according to our estimates, is just beyond $2 trillion.
Since then, we have been spending down those savings.
Moving fees to come to Atlanta to start school and fees for school.
I ended up using some of that fund into buying a new apartment.
We kept our home and our sanity somewhat.
Aminat Ngom, David Liu, and Marge Egan. The personal saving rate fell to just 2.7% last year. It's now at 3.5. Using data available this summer, Oliveira and his colleague estimated we were spending down our excess savings by $100 billion a month earlier this year. And they say we're about to run out.
Well, our latest estimate points to the current quarter. That is the third quarter of 2023.
There are different estimates. Other Fed economists think extra savings already ran out earlier this year. Goldman Sachs analysts say they haven't run out, but we have spent about as much of them as we're going to. And the reality is, of course, different for different people. Some people saved plenty of money without government payments. Some needed those government payments just to get by and saved nothing. Brett Ryan is senior U.S. economist at Deutsche Bank.
You know, a good portion of that savings is also concentrated in the top 20% income cohort. So for the majority of people, that savings is already gone.
That is showing up already in the most sensitive areas of the economy.
There was a big portion during the pandemic when our counseling call volume was down.
Melinda Opperman is with Credit.org, a credit counseling service.
Now we're seeing the call volume pick up.
She says between the loss of savings plus inflation and the end of government programs, people once standing at the financial edge are slipping over it.
We're hearing from many of our clients, they're finding it harder to afford household needs. Some are starting to use their credit cards as a substitution for income, which is really worrisome.
The credit card delinquency rate is now above 2019 levels. The bigger worry is whether the rundown of extra savings is going to be a problem for the economy at large and drag down consumer spending. So far, it's not, says Oliveira at the San Francisco Fed.
That's not where we are. We haven't seen any signs of that yet.
He says extra pandemic savings are not the only thing consumers have going for them.
They could be other sources of savings, their increased wages that we have seen over the past couple of years.
But gas prices are rising, student loan repayments are coming, and having a little less of a cushion does make consumers, who account for 70% of the U.S. economy, a little more vulnerable to any surprises down the line. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Nike reported earnings after the closing bell today, almost $13 billion in revenue for the quarter, $1.5 billion of that profit. The sneaker maker is the most valuable apparel company in the world and is also something of a bellwether for consumer demand. And while, as Sabri was just saying, American shoppers have proven remarkably resilient in the face of higher prices, there are some signs of caution ahead. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on the outlook for apparel sales as we head into the all-important end-of-the-year shopping season.
The outlook for apparel sales has a lot to do with the all-important end-of-the-year shopping season, which has arrived.
Oh, sweater weather.
Sweater weather.
Sweater weather.
Oh, God, I would love
it. Finally, sweater weather.
But there's some softening in the winter shopping forecast this year, says Zachary Waring, an analyst at CFRA.
We don't think it's, you know, an apocalypse. We just think maybe it's flat to down slightly this year.
Inflation has eased, but many low- and middle-income consumers have run through their pandemic savings, and they're still feeling the pinch of higher prices for things like food and gas that they have to buy.
It's kind of the first thing that people cut when, you know, they're in rough times is the non-essentials. If you already have clothes, you don't need more clothes.
And some shoppers could be feeling even more pessimistic with student loan payments resuming next week, says Audrey Chi Reed, an analyst at Forrester.
I do think that there is going to be more of a pause and a hesitancy when it comes to buying.
But she stresses it's a pause from a period of nearly nonstop buying over the last few years. And some people will continue to shop.
Especially in a category like apparel and footwear, where it's so important for consumers to signal, this is who I am, this is my identity. Consumers are going to find a way to buy what they want to buy to show who they are.
They might just be looking in different places, says Sonia Lipinski, a retail strategist at Alex Partners.
They're really trading down. They're being much more cost conscious.
She says discount retailers, fast fashion, and used clothing are likely to do well. So it's a good time for 80s, 90s, and aughts fashion to be back in style. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
David Brancaccio, if you're listening, that one was for you. 80s, 90s, and aughts fashion. I don't know what David wears, but I do know what he does for a living. He's the host of the Marketplace Morning Report, to which you should listen every day. Coming up.
It's too expensive to rent. It's too expensive to buy.
Can't win, can you? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 116 points, one-third of 1%, 33,666. What could possibly go wrong there? The NASDAQ added 108 points, eight-tenths percent, 13,201. The S&P 500 ticked up 25 points, six-tenths percent, 42.99. Delta Airlines is pulling back on the extremely unpopular changes to its frequent flyer program that it announced a couple of weeks ago. The airline CEO Ed Bastian says it went, quote, too far with the tweaks, and he said modifications would be announced in coming weeks. No details from Mr. Bastian yet. Delta stock nonetheless went up 0.8% today. Two airlines have tried to lure Delta loyalists by matching their frequent flyer program. JetBlue soared 2.7%. Alaska Airlines expanded 1.1%. Today is apparently National Drink Beer Day, one of several such holidays celebrating the concoction of malt, hops, yeast, and water, otherwise known as the elixir of life. The Brewers Association, a trade group for craft breweries, estimated that overall beer sales volume in the United States dropped by about 3% in 2022. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Setting politics aside for a second, difficult though that may be, the government shutdown that's coming in something than less than 3 days is bad news. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for government workers and non-government workers, too, by the way. It's bad for companies, big and small, and it is really bad for tribal communities. Everything from police and fire departments to childcare centers and food distribution programs in parts of Indian country are funded or operated by the federal government. And during shutdowns, tribes have to cover the costs of those services out of their own budgets or go without. Tribal leaders, of course, say it doesn't have to be that way. Marketplace's Savannah Marr is on that one.
During the federal government shutdown in 2013, leaders of the Yurok tribe in Northern California had to take a hard look at their budget.
We had a small reserve of about $3 million.
Says Susan Mastin, who was vice chair at the time.
That was not enough to carry through with salaries and with programs.
The nation was forced to furlough about 70 employees. Scholarships went unpaid. Families had to make do without childcare. Things Mastin says Yurok people were owed.
The government has that trust responsibility and the fiduciary obligation to tribes.
An obligation based on treaties, where tribes ceded hundreds of millions of acres of land to the United States in exchange for services like healthcare, education, and housing. Jay Spann heads up the nonprofit Self-Governance Tribal Consortium.
Tribes have upheld their bargain.
But tribal leaders say Congress isn't holding up its end when it fails to safeguard crucial funding.
We view these federal dollars as payment on debt.
Liz Malerba with United South and Eastern Tribes says Congress recognizes that on some level. Last year, it started funding the Indian Health Service a year in advance to protect tribal hospitals and clinics. But Malerba says the IHS is just one crucial service tribes lose access to during shutdowns.
If the federal government were to move all tribal nation funding over to the mandatory side of the budget,
instead of the discretionary side where it lives right now,
that funding would then be insulated
from funding impasses that have become routine and that tribal nations can't afford. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
The National Association of Realtors said today that pending home sales, that's an offer made and accepted, but not yet a deal finalized, they were off 7.1% last month after 2 months of increases. Pending sales are a forward-looking indicator, right? Pending. Today, though, we're going to take a look back a little bit at some other housing data. As of last year, more than half of millennials have become homeowners. But for the biggest generation in this economy, getting there was not easy. Vanessa Wong wrote about it in The Guardian the other day. Vanessa, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
I confess I was intrigued by the headline on this piece, and we all know that writers don't get to write their own headline, but it says most U.S. millennials finally own homes, and that surprised me.
It surprised me, too. So millennials have been sort of characterized for such a long time as a generation that's faced a lot of economic hardship, particularly with the housing market, mm-hmm. which has continued to rise while wages stagnated for decades, honestly. So 2022, we saw millennials become a majority homeowner generation, which meant 51.5% of millennials now own a home. So it's a small majority, but hey, you know, they crossed over that middle line.
I was just going to say, a majority is a majority, no matter how slim it is.
Indeed.
Okay, so what happened? What got millennials from being really challenged, actually, to, you know, in 2022, so many of them owning homes?
There was a number of conditions created during the pandemic that surprisingly put a lot of people in a position to buy. So we had, probably most importantly, low interest rates at that point. We had an emergency pause on student loan payments. People were benefiting from stimulus checks. And then the pandemic also mainstreamed remote work. So a lot of people were able to move to areas with more affordable housing than sort of America's central job markets.
One hates to be a downer here, but that window of opportunity, of economic opportunity that you just described for a lot of these folks does seem to have closed, right? Because student loan payments are coming back on. Interest rates, I don't think we need to mention because everybody knows where they are. So those millennials who got in are the fortunate ones in that like 2-3 year period.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, for a brief moment, people caught a break, but we are seeing a reversal. Trends show that millennials still aren't where previous generations had been. Just by way of data, by age 30, 42% of millennials own their homes, and that's compared to 48% of Gen X, for example.
Right. We should remind folks why home ownership matters entirely apart from the whole American dream thing, which has its own, you know, challenges as a reality-based proposition. But owning a home in this economy is the single best way to build wealth.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people continue to look at home ownership as a wealth building tool. It's difficult right now, especially when you have other forms of debt, when you have student loan debt, medical debt, credit card debt. So, yeah, I mean, home ownership is just, I think a lot of people are questioning the value of a lot of things that we saw as investments in our future before, home ownership and honestly, like higher education included.
Mm-hmm. None of my business, and I don't want to ask you how old you are, but are you a millennial?
Oh, yes.
Oh, all right. Okay. So what are you? So number one, are you looking at a house or were you looking at a house? And number two, what about your friends and your sort of age group colleagues?
So I am one of these old millennials. I graduated from grad school in the middle of the Great Recession. Oh, so wow. A lot of times when I write these stories, you know, I can relate to a lot of the experiences that people are telling me about just what they've gone through and sort of what, I guess, their expectations for their future would be versus what the reality has turned into. Housing is, for a lot of my peers, a huge challenge. I mean, I live in New York City, so no matter what, housing is not on your side. It's too expensive to rent. It's too expensive to buy. You know, on a personal level, I mean, I live in the same neighborhood that I grew up in Brooklyn, and I couldn't afford my parents' house. So,
wow.
You know, and I, you know, I think I have a decent career and job. So I don't know. It feels kind of hopeless sometimes. I laugh because there's no other option.
laugh and so you don't cry.
Indeed.
Vanessa
yeah.
Wong, writing in The Guardian about millennials and home ownership. Vanessa, thanks a lot. It's good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, too.
This final note on the way out today, if you decide for some reason you want to go see the New York Jets game this Sunday, the woeful New York Jets, I should more properly say, it's going to cost you. Ticket prices on the secondary market are up somewhere in the 40% range, depending on the reseller you're using. It might make more sense when I tell you the Kansas City Chiefs are in town. Travis Kelce, Taylor Swift, clearly she is the most important economic force on the planet right now. All right, off we go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It is kind of weedy, but interesting, too, I think, in a weedy kind of way. One more item from this morning's final revision of second quarter gross domestic product. The Bureau of Economic Analysis, way down in the fine print, says the pandemic recession from the end of 2019 through June of 2020 was just a little less bad than they had first estimated. GDP shrank 17.5% in those 6 months, which was 0.7 percentage point better than they had thought. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Cardiant, the Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.